The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Now we step into the lunchtime, Doctor. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Dean. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Tuska, and good afternoon to all the listeners out there. It is the last lunchtime doctor for the week, but of course, we do have a very interesting topic to discuss yet again, and we are still on, diseases of the liver. So today we're going to be talking about liver failure, but of course, while we are talking about this specific topic, anybody can feel free to call in or send a WhatsApp on any of their medical conditions, and we will have a discussion surrounding it as well.
All right, and let's get to the questions today. What is liver failure and how does it differ from other liver diseases?
So liver failure really occurs when the liver itself loses the ability to perform, of course, its essential functions. And we know those as, you know, its function for filtering toxins, for producing proteins that are essential for blood clots, for regulating digestion and metabolism as well. And I would say that liver failure is different from other liver diseases because it really represents the end stage of liver damage. And this is the point where the liver can no longer compensate for the injury that has been caused to it. There are other liver conditions like fatty liver disease, hepatitis, fibrosis. All of these things may cause damage, but the liver will often still function, at least partially. Once too many of the liver cells become damaged or they die, the liver cannot keep up, and that is what leads to failure. People tend to think that liver failure is something that only happens in alcoholics, and yes, we know that excessive alcohol use is definitely a significant cause, but there are many other factors like viral infections, medications, autoimmune conditions, even obesity and certain toxins can lead to liver failure as well. The key difference from the less severe liver conditions is that liver failure is definitely life-threatening, and it does require urgent treatment to prevent any sort of complications that affect the entire body.
And the next question is, what are the main differences between acute chronic liver failure, and why does this distinction matter?
So acute liver failure often develops rapidly. So within a few days or even within a few weeks in somebody who has had no previous liver disease at all. So the common causes we would see that are implicated in acute liver failure would be things like viral hepatitis or severe drug reactions to things like the paracetamol or the acetaminophen overdose. Toxins as well, or even sudden immune-related attacks in persons who have autoimmune diseases. And because it happens so quickly, these persons are going to develop symptoms like jaundice, which we spoke about at length yesterday, confusion, bleeding disorders. These things will tend to appear suddenly, and that is what makes it a medical emergency. Now, chronic liver failure, on the other hand, that is something that usually results from long-term damage to the liver, so over months to years. And the most common causes would be alcoholic liver disease and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease as well, which we spoke about on Monday. Viral hepatitis can also cause that chronic liver failure and other autoimmune conditions as well. And I would say that the distinction between acute and chronic really matters, because acute liver failure can sometimes be reversed if it is treated early. But chronic liver failure will often lead to permanent scarring, which we know as cirrhosis. So early detection and, of course, lifestyle changes now become very critical to prevent chronic liver failure from progressing to the end-stage liver disease.
What are the most common causes of liver failure worldwide and specifically in Trinidad and Tobago?
So, globally, the leading causes of liver failure would be viral hepatitis. So, hepatitis A, B, and C. Of course, excessive alcohol consumption, fatty liver disease, autoimmune liver disease, and even drug-induced liver injury. Acetaminophen overdose is actually the most common cause of acute liver failure in many countries, while chronic hepatitis B and C infections usually account for most of the chronic liver failure cases worldwide. Now, in Trinidad and Tobago, the main contributors are, of course, alcohol-related liver disease and uncontrolled diabetes leading to fatty liver disease and even chronic hepatitis B and C infections as well. There's also a growing concern about obesity-driven non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which of course is increasing now because of lifestyle changes and the diet patterns and the modern dietary habits that we do have. And understanding, of course, the local risk factors really helps us to start focusing on the prevention strategies like the vaccinations for hepatitis, healthier diets, and of course, reducing the alcohol intake. And all of these procedures can save a person's life.
What role do alcohol, obesity, hepatitis, and medications play in causing liver damage?
So, alcohol is one of the most common causes of chronic liver damage, and regular heavy drinking will cause an accumulation of fat in the liver. It will cause inflammation in the liver, and eventually, all of that leads to scarring or cirrhosis of the liver. People tend to think that it's only the quote unquote hard liquor that damages the liver, but in reality, beer, wine, spirits, all of these things equally contribute when it is consumed in excess. Obesity also leads to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, where you have fat building up inside of the liver and causing inflammation as well. And of course, over time, that progresses to the non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which we also discussed on Monday, and leads to cirrhosis in the long term. When we look at viral hepatitis, especially hepatitis B and C, they directly attack the liver cells, and that will lead to chronic damage in the long term. And even certain medications and toxins, so the paracetamol, the antibiotics, even the herbal supplements, all of these things can trigger acute liver failure if it is used in high doses or if it is used unsafely. So it is always important to check the safety of your medication with your doctor, especially if you have some form of existing liver disease.
What are the early warning signs and symptoms of liver failure that people should never ignore?
So the early symptoms of liver failure are often very, and it can be mistaken for fatigue or stress, which is why the condition itself is sometimes diagnosed late. Now, the common signs would be a person who is persistently tired, if they have loss of appetite, nausea, abdominal pain, and mild yellowing of the eyes or the skin, which we know as jaundice. Now, these early indicators, they should not be ignored, especially if you have the risk factors like heavy alcohol use, hepatitis, or even obesity. As liver failure progresses, the symptoms are going to become more severe, and people tend to experience things like confusion, easily becoming bruised about the body, swelling of the abdomen, which is known as ascites, bleeding in the gums, and even dark urine. And people tend to think that jaundice in adults, which we mentioned yesterday, can be treated with home remedies, or it can just easily be ignored and it will just go away. But jaundice often signals significant liver damage, and it does require urgent medical evaluation.
And the next question is, how does the liver normally function and why does its failure affect so many systems in the body?
So the liver is definitely one of the most important organs in the body. It is actually responsible for over 500 functions. It processes nutrients, it detoxifies the harmful substances in the body, it produces bile for digestion, and it even helps to regulate a person's blood sugar and cholesterol levels. It also makes proteins that are essential for blood clotting and for our immune functioning as well. And when the liver fails, all of these processes become disrupted. And in doing so, the toxins are going to accumulate in the bloodstream. Digestion becomes impaired. Your bleeding risks increase and your immune defenses are now weakened. And because the liver interacts with so many systems, its failure can cause widespread complications that affect the brain, the heart, the kidneys, and of course your overall metabolism. And that is why early recognition and treatment are definitely critical to preventing essentially multi-organ failure from occurring in the body.
All right, folks, our base is in. Thank you very much, Tusker, for holding on there. 70 minutes after 12 o'clock. And in the meantime, of course, I'll give out your numbers and we will have some of your questions coming in there at 625-2257, 627-3223. We also have a Dalton Brong, optometrist from Dalton Brong, coming in at about 12:30, I believe. So get your questions in quick, any of your questions for the lunchtime, doctor. Let's get one right away. Line two, hello. Line one, hello. All right, 625-2257, 627-3223. Seeing the number there, so I'll give you a couple of seconds to redial and get in. Remember, of course, we're also on, well, besides Freedom 106.5 FM, we're on Sangit 106.1 and Sky 99.5. Hello.
Good afternoon, there, and to the honorable doctor. Can you tell us what can we do to protect the liver? What kind of foods can we use to protect the liver? Thank you.
So in terms of protecting the liver, I would say that you need to first have a liver-friendly diet. And a liver-friendly diet is essentially a diet that is healthy in all aspects. So focusing on the whole, the unprocessed foods. So choosing your vegetables, your fruits, your whole grains, and your lean protein sources like the chicken, the fish, etc. And of course, your healthy fats like the olive oil, the avocado, the fatty fishes, and limiting the refined sugars, the processed foods, because these things can cause or worsen fatty liver disease. And hydration also matters because you need to drink enough water daily to support that detoxification and metabolism. Now, in terms of just eating the healthy foods, that is great, but we also have to be able to limit the alcohol consumption. And for healthy adults, you have to keep the alcohol consumption less than 2 drinks per day for men and less than 1 drink per day for women. And if you already have liver disease, hepatitis, all of these different things, I would suggest that you avoid alcohol completely. And maintaining a healthy weight, and this is going to be through, of course, your diet and your exercise routine, moving on a daily basis. All of these things do help to prevent alcoholic fatty liver disease and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in the long run.
All right, another question here. Doctor, what are some of the early signs of a stroke? Early signs of a stroke.
So when we're looking at a stroke, there is actually a rule that we usually tell persons to remember, and that is FAST. So F is for facial drooping. If one side of your face starts to look uneven, or it droops down, or it starts to feel numb, and for example, if the person is trying to smile and half of it is crooked, that is a warning sign. E is for arm weakness. So if you get sudden weakness or numbness in one arm or one leg, then that is also another early warning sign. S is for slurred speech or speech difficulty. If the person's speech gets very slurred, very slow, if their speech starts to sound stranger than usual, and if they have trouble understanding words as well, this is another warning sign. And T, it is time to go to the hospital. So if you notice any of the previous signs, it is time to call the ambulance and go to the hospital.
All right, let's get a WhatsApp message here at 3061065. You're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor.
Hello and good afternoon, Doc, and continue doing a good job. What I would like to know, do we have any equipment or scanner machine or CT, I don't know which one, in this modern time that any nursing home or institute could bring it that could scan people and identify if they have any sign of cancer at this stage, at an earlier stage? And what I would like to that the Ministry of Health to do, you know, just like how we have pressure and sugar, they could identify. I think overweight should be on that list too, that when we identify, because sometimes you just can't tell anybody, you know, close or near neighbors, friends, you can't tell them they're overweight. It's an offensive thing. So I think the ministry should acknowledge and highlight that at an early stage, from primary school to preschool. You know, there is a weight, which is the correct weight, and I think the institute, the medical institute, is the correct institute to highlight that. Have a good day.
So in terms of the initial comment, in terms of screening for cancers, there are many modalities for screening for cancers, and it is going to be dependent on the type of cancer. So, for example, for surgical cancer, we'll have the pap smears. For breast cancer, we'll have the mammograms. For colon cancer, we'll have the fecal immunochemical test. We'll have the colonoscopy. We have ultrasound imaging and prostate exams available as well for prostate cancer. So detecting cancer is dependent on the type of cancer, and that will, of course, that will be the leverage for what sort of modality is used to detect that type of cancer. When somebody is diagnosed with cancer, there are also screening protocols. So we do a CT, chest, abdomen, and pelvis to stage the cancer, to see if the cancer, for example, if it's breast cancer, if it has spread to other areas of the body itself. So there are imaging protocols for the different types of cancers, and there are also staging protocols as well.
All right, we just have about 6 more minutes. We're going to Dalton Brong shortly. Let's get back to the liver questions. How is a liver failure diagnosed, and what tests and scans are typically used?
So, of course, your doctor is going to start off with your physical exam and taking a detailed history to look for any symptoms and risk factors. And blood tests here are going to become key. For example, we'll do a liver function test to look at the enzymes of the liver, like the ALT and the AST. We'll look at the bilirubin levels and even certain proteins like albumin. And we'll also look and see if the person has abnormal clotting times, which can also be a signal of severe liver damage. Remember, the liver also produces clotting factors. And if that clotting time becomes very prolonged, then that means that there is some sort of problem within the production of these clotting factors, and therefore a problem in the liver. And even certain scans like the ultrasound, the CT, the MRI, they help to assess the structure of the liver and to detect signs of cirrhosis or even tumors that may be present in the liver itself. And in some cases, a biopsy or a piece of the liver may be taken to understand the extent of the damage itself. People tend to think that liver failure can only be diagnosed when the symptoms are very severe, but in reality, routine blood work can actually detect early liver damage before the symptoms even start to occur.
And what are the complications of liver failure, such as jaundice, fluid buildup, bleeding, or confusion?
So liver failure actually leads to several dangerous complications because the liver no longer can perform its normal functioning. Jaundice, like we spoke about yesterday, is that bilirubin buildup in the blood, and that causes yellowing of the skin and the eyes. Ascites, or a buildup of that fluid in the abdomen, usually happens when the liver fails to produce enough proteins to maintain fluid balance in the body. Other complications would be things like hepatic encephalopathy, where the toxins start to spread to the brain and it starts to affect brain functioning. And that leads to confusion, irritability, even coma in some of the patients. Liver failure can also affect blood clotting, like I just mentioned. So it does increase the risk of severe bleeding, and it can lead to kidney failure, which we know as hepatorenal syndrome. And all of these complications do make liver failure a very life-threatening condition that is going to require immediate hospital care.
And who is most at risk of developing liver failure, and are there lifestyle or genetic factors involved?
So persons who are at a higher risk would be the persons who drink heavily, if you have a history of chronic hepatitis infections, if you're overweight or obese, or if you have a family history of liver disease as well. There are genetic disorders like hemochromatosis, where you have an iron overload in the liver, and even Wilson's disease, where you have a copper buildup, which also increases the risk. Lifestyle factors also play a major role, like consuming alcohol heavily, having a poor diet, one that is rich in refined sugars in the processed foods, and a sedentary behavior, unsafe medication use as well. And people tend to think that young people, the healthy persons, are immune. But in reality, acute liver failure can happen at any age because of infections, because of overdoses, or even because of autoimmune attacks.
All right, of course, two more minutes coming up. We have a segment from Dalton Brong, optometrist. You could slip in one more question there on our topic of the liver failure. How can hepatitis infections A, B, and C lead to liver failure, and can they be prevented?
So hepatitis A usually causes short-term illness, and it rarely leads to liver failure. But when we look at hepatitis B and C, they are actually the major culprits behind chronic liver disease and cirrhosis worldwide. These viruses start to attack the liver cells, causing inflammation and long-term damage if it is left untreated. The good news is that hepatitis B is preventable through vaccination, and hepatitis C is now curable with modern antiviral medications. So practicing safe sex, avoiding shared needles, ensuring blood products are very much screened are key prevention measures. But people tend to think that hepatitis only affects persons with poor hygiene or risky behaviors, but track these viruses without having proper precautions.
All right, folks, so it's 12:30, and as promised, we have our friends from Dalton Brong, optometrist on the line. I'm seeing Andrea Carter there. I don't know if the rest of the team is there with her as well. So we say good afternoon and welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
We have Miss Alvary with us today as well.
Good afternoon. So today we are talking about Children's Eye Health Month, and I guess the first question is going to be, why is it important that a child's eyes are tested?
Well, it actually is very crucial to test a child's eyes, reason being to detect and address any potential vision problems early, as these issues, you know, can significantly impact a child's development, their learning, and overall well-being. So early detection allows for timely intervention, which can obviously prevent vision problems from becoming more serious and also a little more difficult to treat later in life.
And what are some of the signs that a child's eyes may need to be tested?
Okay, so we could split that into two portions. So visual signs that the parents can look out for would be, you know, the obvious, which would be squinting, like if they realize they're trying to watch TV or something and they're squinting a lot to notice the television, or a lot of teachers as well pick up on it and they actually relay that information to the parents that, you know, your child has been squinting a lot, to make out the information on the board, rubbing the eyes a lot, as that could lead to other conditions in the eyes as well, misaligned or cross eyes. So sometimes, like if the child is looking straight ahead, you want to make sure that both eyes are aligned. Also look out for if the child is under a lot of stress or those things, sometimes the eyes might wander out or inwards. So you want to look out for those things as well. And droopy eyelids or cloudy pupils, as those signs can lead us to think that there are other conditions that's going on in the eyes. Behavioral signs that we can look out for would be difficulty reading, poor school performance. The child is complaining of a lot of headaches and eye strain as well. So all those are some signs to look out for that will help either the parents or teachers, those who are in close contact with the children on a regular basis, to see if something is wrong or not.
And how do the issues with vision start to affect a child's performance in school?
So children with visual issues will sometimes feel frustrated and avoid activities in school that require high visual demand. And this will cause them to behave differently in a classroom setting. So for instance, if they can't see things clearly or can't see them at all, they might write the wrong thing in their books compared to what was written on the whiteboard. Therefore, they might think that what they've written is correct when doing homework or doing tests in class, but what they've written is actually incorrect. So, of course, their grades would subsequently be affected, as well as their motivation to do the schoolwork, because they will feel discouraged as they may not be performing as well as their friends.
It's also good with that as well to bring the kid in to test their eyes, because even if it's not a visual issue, we could pick up, well, not us, but we could refer accordingly to detect, like, if there's an actual learning disability or something like that, once we rule out that the vision is good.
And how often should a child's eyes be tested?
So commonly, children should be tested at least every 2 years. However, children that have significant vision problems, or if they have risk factors for certain things, they might need to be seen in shorter time intervals, like every year, every 6 months. Sometimes it could even be every 3 months. And that's just for us to monitor the visual changes very closely for the benefit of the child. So one instance where the shorter intervals might apply is if the child is short-sighted. So we want to ensure that the child is not becoming too short-sighted too quickly. But if they are progressing quite quickly, then we could do something called myopia management, which Ms. Carter and Mr. Lockwood have spoken about a couple months ago. But just a reminder, it's where we do different techniques to slow down how quickly the child is becoming short-sighted, just to protect the overall health of the eyes.
And how does screen time really affect a child's eyes?
So excessive screen time can negatively impact their eyes by leading to digital eye strain, dry eyes, and even contributing to the development of myopia or short-sightedness, which is one of the major effects. Reason being, when a child spends too much time on the devices, it causes them to end up short-sighted. Also, with the digital eye strain, they could end up with a lot of dryness in the eyes and all those things. So it's just something to look out for. And we'll also talk about tips to how to mitigate the impacts of the digital eye strain as well.
So how can parents mitigate that digital eye strain in their kids?
So I don't know if you ever heard of, or anyone, if they ever heard of the 20-20-20 rule, which is basically to take breaks. So every 20 minutes, they look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds. They can also consider blue light filters on the glasses, or even, I know some devices have that option on the screens as well, to mitigate the amount of light entering the eyes and reducing that strain. So they can adjust the screen settings there. They can also stay hydrated, as not drinking enough water and whatnot can also lead to a lot of dryness of the eyes. And then when you're on the screens, it just makes the symptoms even worse. So staying hydrated is important as well.
And how can nearsightedness be managed in children?
So we could split this up into two parts as well. So if we're talking about what the parents could do at home, they could have their children do activities outdoors, so spend time in the sun, play different sports, and they could reduce the length of time that they do near activities at home, whether that be when they're doing studies, if they're on devices, if they're on tablets, iPads, stuff like that, because these things could help slow down how quickly they become short-sighted. If we're talking about what we could do when a child comes to see us as optometrists, we could manage a nearsightedness progression with either special contact lenses, certain eye drops could be used as well, and we could fit the children with either single vision or multifocal glasses to kind of help them relax the muscles as much as they can throughout the day. But ultimately, bringing the child in for the regular eye exams is very important, and it would allow us to tailor the management to the child's specific needs.
And how can children protect their eyes during activities like sports?
So some sports or activities are better than the child wears protective eyewear, like goggles or face shields or helmets that have the guard over the face as well, in order to mitigate anything coming into contact with the eyes, whether it be like a ball from cricket or something like that. And in these cases, once a child is mature enough, we might fit them with contact lenses so that they could wear the goggles, etc., more easily. If we're talking about when we're doing up a pair of glasses, we'll make sure that they choose a frame that is durable, one that fits well, and one that's designed for the use, depending on a certain sport and activity, that would give the child some eye protection as well.
So just to add to that, or to stress how important it is to actually protect their child's eyes during sports, I've actually had a couple of young male patients that came in with cataract. Now, we know cataract to be something that's age-related, therefore we would expect to see that in much older patients. However, there is also cataract formation due to trauma, which can happen at any age. So in some cases, with the patients, young patients, as I would have seen, the cataract was small, so it was not affecting their vision as much, so no treatment was required, whereas others had to actually undergo cataract surgery, all of which could have been avoided if the children or even the parents were educated properly on proper eye protection during certain sports, so like things like cricket, football, and all those things.
And how can children take care of their glasses to have them last until their next appointments?
So sometimes that's probably easier said than done with some kids, with how they handle, but the most we could do is enforce certain actions. So with parents or guardians, they can show the child just how to properly handle the glasses. We always advise to use both hands to put on and to remove. And with kids, they learn a lot by looking at other people. So as the parents, you know, if you own a pair of glasses, don't just take it off with one hand. Do the same thing that you will want your child to do as well, so they can do the proper thing. Also, cleaning up the lenses with proper solution and lens cloth will also help the lenses to remain in good condition. And placing the glasses in the casing, so it remains safe there, instead of probably just like throwing it in the book bag or on the couch or all those things.
And what can parents do to ensure that their children's eyes are as healthy as possible?
So we would advise to bring them in to test yearly, also to know your family history, because a lot of ocular conditions are passed down through the gene pool. So if anyone in the family has been diagnosed with a vision disorder, then your child is at a higher risk of developing them as well. So sharing this information with us, as in the optometrist or even the ophthalmologist, will ensure that any conditions that may arise will be detected and effectively managed before the condition progresses. We want to ensure healthy eating habits, limit screen time as much as possible. If they have to do it for maximum 2 hours a day, we would advise to take breaks. So follow the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds. Wear protective eyewear during sports. Spend time outdoors as the sunlight is very good for their eyes as well. Limit eye rubbing. Be consistent with the treatments recommended, be it glasses, vision therapy, all those things. And if you are unsure of certain things, also ask questions for better understanding.
And what tips do you have for parents to give them a better chance at properly caring for their children's eyes?
So definitely, we can't stress this enough. You need to book your child's routine eye exams, whether it be every year, every couple of months, depending on what the optometrist advises. And follow the optometrist advice as best as you can. Don't be afraid to be transparent with your optometrist about things like the child's hobbies and their lifestyle habits, because you'd be surprised how useful this information is for us in terms of personalizing the management for the child, whether that may be with glasses, with contact lenses, or otherwise. Get your child to wear their glasses if they were prescribed by allowing them to choose well-fitting frames that they like. So children are not going to wear glasses that they don't like, so don't try to force the child to choose something that you like and they're obviously telling you that they don't want to wear. And as Ms. Carter said, you need to lead by example if you yourself wear your glasses. So try to have on your glasses as much as possible. If they're going to see you doing it, they're going to want to do it a lot more. And the last thing they could do is explain to them the benefits of wearing the glasses and try to make it a positive experience overall. So during the eye test, the optometrist will often go over that at the end of the eye exam. So parents could just jot it down, make a note on their phone so they'll know what to remember to tell their kids if they find that the kids leaning towards not wanting to wear their glasses, whether it be at home or at school.
So thank you so much to Dalton Brown, optometrists, for enlightening us about Children's Eye Health Month. And is there anything that you'd like to say to the listeners about this particular month, just to end off things? And I'm sure that there are people out there who have a lot of questions about it, so we'll leave the lines open for that as well.
Sure. Well, you know, our usual motto would be to have regular eye exams, and only from there, depending on the child's condition, then we'll be able to know how to act accordingly from there.
Okay, great. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. And I'm sure that there are people out there who do have questions. So basically, we can leave the lines open for any questions pertaining to eye health or Children's Eye Awareness Month.
All right, folks. Of course, the numbers to call in for, we're talking about the eyes today, 625-2257, 627-3223, and feel free to WhatsApp us at 306-1065. We had somebody online here, because I got my friend Dana here from 95 in studio, said that they were wearing glasses from 4 years old. How can you tell if your child from an early age needs glasses?
How can you?
Can you tell from your child at an early age that needs glasses? How can you tell?
Right. So you could look out for the signs in terms of squinting, eye rubbing, or just like certain behaviors in terms of like how they're performing in school, if they're writing the wrong stuff from the board, if they're sitting and all those things. Now, those are just the little signs to look out for. But if you don't see any of those signs, but you know there's also a family history, as in the parents would have worn glasses or they started at a very young age, then that's sign enough to bring them in to test their eyes, and then we'll have like a proper answer on that as well.
And just to add what Ms. Carter was saying there, culturally it's more common for me to hear that parents are saying that their children are hardened and they just don't want to do their schoolwork, but they think that the child could see. If a child is actually avoiding doing schoolwork or avoiding reading when they're really, really young, that could actually be a sign that they're not seeing and they just don't know how to express that to you. Because remember, the child doesn't know that everyone else is seeing differently to them. So you really want to take into consideration those signs as well. Yes, some children may be hardened, but a lot of the times you'd be surprised. It's really just that the child needs some help visually.
Yeah, because we've had a lot of patients, they came in, they're sitting on the chair, you know, you ask them, so you have any problems with the eyes?
Welcome to Corby Bush Ministries, Trinidad and Tobago. Prepare your hearts and minds for a powerful word from God. If you'd like prayer, contact us. Call 868-707-8992.
Go to the office and check your eyes. Is there any other way to probably check your eyes besides going into, you know, in the office?
No. Okay. I'll say no. There are usually the vision screenings that, you know, you see them pop up in certain areas, but that only assesses the vision. It does not check to see if they require glasses or check the health of the eyes. So you really need to come in for a comprehensive eye exam.
What about for dried eyes? What do you use for dried eyes? Is there a recommended, you know, eye wash to use? I remember back in the days, we used to have these eye washes. You just used to use it just like that. But for dried eyes, what is, you know, there for dried eyes?
So you have a few treatments for dry eyes now. It depends on the type of dry eyes. So a lot of people don't know you could have different types. Some of them could be where your tears are just evaporating very quickly. Some of them could be where the oil part of your tears is not as efficient as it needs to be. So when we do our comprehensive eye exam, we take a close look at the health of the front of the eye. So we look at the tear layer, and we are able to decipher whether it's evaporative, whether they need more oils in their tears, and then we have different eye drops to suit the particular needs, as well as you have some practices where we might tell patients to do something called warm compresses. So that's where you just heat up some water, you take a warm washcloth, and you just massage it over the eyes for a couple of minutes. That's if the patient has the glands at the eyelids clogged, which means that their tears would not be flowing and changing as nicely as we would like them to be. The eye washes still exist. We have better ones now than they did back in the day. That's more if the patient has like debris in their eyes that they may need to rinse out, that might be giving them the dry eye feeling as well. But we check all of that in detail when we do the full comprehensive eye exam.
You have a question. How close is too close, you know, to be sitting to your TV and your screens? What is the perfect distance or the, you know, distance to sit from your TV or your screens, computer screens?
For computer, we would say arm's length. I can't really give a proper distance for television, but I think you'll know if you're sitting a little too close or abnormally close, where you would suspect that something is wrong if they can't see it sitting from like on the couch or the table compared to where the television is set up.
And what causes your eyes to water? There's some people eyes will just water like that. What causes your eyes to water?
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny enough that dry eyes causes that at times. Sometimes when the eyes are too dry, it ends up producing even more tears. So that's how you get the watery eyes as well. Or it could be signs of other things like infections and those things, but that's just a broad answer to it.
And is there a medical term for this trini thing that we have, what we use called a yampi in the eye? You know, is there a medical term for it? And what causes that really?
I don't know if they're probably referring to like coal or like a discharge.
The coal buildup.
Yeah. So we'd say that's basically like a discharge. Sometimes you can get that with certain types of dry eyes, or it could be infections as well. So an eye infection.
All right, we do have a question coming in here. Let's take line one. Hello, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. This question is about astigmatism. Can astigmatism be hereditary, or can it develop later on, maybe early teens, or is it stress-related, or can it be stress-related? Thank you.
So astigmatism can be hereditary, yes. So if your parents or your grandparents had it, the child is more likely to develop it at some point during their lives. You can also develop it if the child is rubbing their eyes a lot. So when they rub their eyes, particularly with the knuckles of their hands, it could change the shape of the front of the eye slightly, which is what induces that astigmatism. So the child might see things a little bit blurred. They might get a lot of glare issues, especially when they're looking at screens and stuff. It's very unlikely to be stress-related. So if your vision is changing due to stress, it might be some other type of problem that you'll be able to detect when you do the eye exam.
All right. Let's get another question here. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to all. Doctors, I'm in my 70s. I recently did cataract surgery in the third month of this year. And you wouldn't believe that I could read, although I only did one eye after the other eye, I am seeing, reading fine print on prescription, everything, although I haven't done the other eye as it is scheduled in November to do it. So I'm just urging people out there to go get tested, check your eyes, and you wouldn't believe that the scenery out there that you will see. Thank you very much.
So I'm really glad that you had that positive experience after the cataract surgery. And yes, those people that have cataracts, they never know how much they're missing out until they actually get it done. One thing I will say, though, is I'm assuming they may have scheduled you to do the other eye sometime in the near future. You still want to be careful not to strain the good eye, because now your good eye is doing all the work for you, which is why you're seeing so clearly. And sometimes if you wait too long to do the other eye could get lazy. So you might lose a little more vision in that eye than, you know, than is ideal. But I'm really happy to hear that your surgery went well.
All right, folks, that seems to be it for questions for the eyes for today. 8 minutes away from 1 o'clock. Anything you would like to say again, our friend, some Dalton Brown optometrist?
Hi, no, I don't think we have anything else to add right now. So we'll stay for any further questions until the time.
Well, that seems to be it for the questions for today. Some of our questions are coming in were medical questions for the regular lunchtime doctor. Yeah. I see a question coming in here. Let me see. All right. We do have one. Hi, I'm 40 years old. My eyes burn and water whilst driving in AC, making it difficult. Also out in the sun of bright lit areas. What can I do?
So in relation to you feeling like the eyes are burning in the AC, that is a very, very common complaint. You're not alone there. It's just that the air conditioner is probably drying out the front of the eyes. So when you don't have a smooth surface of tears over the front of the eyes, you will get that burning sensation, which is also how the eyes start to water, as Ms. Carter was talking about earlier. So it goes back to what we were saying about when we check what kind of dryer that you have, we'll be able to recommend either a specific drop. You might need to do the warm compresses. But ideally, just try to angle the AC away from your face as best as you could. That's about it.
All right. Good afternoon. A question from the optometrist, please. For an adult, is an eye pressure of 21 in one of your eyes an okay reading, or is it cause for concern?
So normal eye pressure would be 10 to 21. So it still falls within the normal range. However, there are further tests that we do, which is something called pachymetry, where we measure the front surface of the eyes, which is called the cornea. So sometimes if that front surface is either too thick or it's too thin, we will have to adjust the eye pressure value that we got. Now, we usually only take those steps when we see certain things in the eye exam that would lead us to go into that direction. So for the 21, as of right now, it's still within the normal range.
In terms of eye pressure testing, how is that done?
So you come into the office and we have, there's a machine, a specific machine we use where we put in a probe and it just gently touches the front surface of the eye and we get the value from that.
Okay, let's get a question here. Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah,
can you speak up, please? We could hardly hear you, sir.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm talking to the doctor about blurry vision.
What causes blurry vision?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Listen to us off here. Blurry vision. Any of the causes for blurry vision?
So there are a whole host of causes of blurry vision. It could either be that they might be short-sighted, long-sighted, or have astigmatism. They may have something like cataracts. So when you have cataracts in the eyes, overall your vision tends to get very cloudy, and things may see a little bit, may seem a bit dazzly, especially when you're out in the sun or if you're night driving. If the eyes are dry, you could also get blurry vision because the light from whatever you're looking at is not going to go straight to the back of the eye. It's going to scatter a little bit before it reaches there, which causes you to see blurry.
A whole lot of things. But now I have behaved myself. Like one wing from the breast. In other words, I used to act like a child. When I was a child, I thought like a child.
The eyes. So that's just a general idea of what could cause blurry vision, but it's so broad. We'd be here whole day if we were talking about blurry vision alone.
Right, of course. Well, you see, I mean, part of it could be, I know diabetes as well, too. Sometimes a person could probably go check their blood sugar, HbA1c, that sort of thing as well, right?
Yes, yeah, they can. Because some patients, when they come in, they would complain about the blurry vision and they would say they're diabetic. Now, one of the effects of diabetes on the eyes is that when it's not controlled, when it's not within the normal range, you can get blurry vision. So we would see on a regular where they come in complaining about that. So we check the sugar level. It's 300, 400, 500. So it has a serious impact on the eyes.
All right, I have a question. Aqualia, hello, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Doctor, I want to find out a little more about dry eyes. I'm experiencing dry eyes, so I was wondering, when you have dry eyes, do you see like little dazzles in front of your eyes? Like, I'm a little concerned about that. Thank you.
So, I'm not too sure what she's referring to. In terms of the dazzle, maybe sometimes she gets a little blue and as she blinks, it comes back clear because that's a very a common complaint of it. Or if it is, she's maybe seeing like little spots or something in her vision, which would be something else known as floaters, right? But the only way we'll be able to give you a proper answer, obviously, is if you come in for us to fully assess the eyes and then we'll know what's going on.
All right, so we're just 2 minutes away from 1 o'clock. Let's just give again your location for Dalton Brown Optometrist so people can come in and check you guys out.
So we're located in Arima. We're on the corner of Colleen Street and Susanna Street. And if anyone wants to book an appointment with us, they could call 667-3115 or they could call or WhatsApp 299-3115.
Mm-hmm. And you could get all your prescriptions, lenses, frames, everything there as well, right?
Yes, correct. We can do everything in our office.
Nice, beautiful. Do you recommend there are some people who would have reading glasses and there are some glasses that people want to have just, you know, to go out of, but we have a different style. Do they have to be the same prescription or could they be different?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question. So you're asking
There's some people want to have glasses just for reading, like from at work. You're at work right now, you want to have those glasses, you read a lot at work. And then there are some people who you would need glasses, but you want to have a glasses just for style. You want to have a different frame just for style. Do they have to be of the same prescription or can there be something a little different if you're not like into reading off, obviously, when you're going out?
Yes, so they can. So a lot of people tend to do two in cases. Just wanted for like events and stuff. They may just take a pair where it's only the distance prescription because they don't think they're going to be doing a lot of reading in the event. And then they have their office pair or their home pair where you have, maybe if they're far-sighted, you just have that prescription. If they have a different prescription to see far and a different prescription to see near, we'll do something called a progressive lens. So they'll be able to use it for all the distances. So you have lots and lots of options.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is mostly applicable for patients 40 years and over, because before 40, you would only have one prescription in your eyes. After 40, the muscles just don't work as well as they used to before. So now you may have a prescription for distance, and then you also have a prescription for reading.
All right. Thank you there very much, ladies. And that'll be the end of it for today. Our lunchtime doctor and, of course, our friends at Dalton Brown and optometrist.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
See you next week.
Nice, man. For today, Wednesday, how time flies already. For those folks who are sent in some questions late, we'll get your questions in next week. Of course, you've been listening to the Lunchtime Doctor right here, and our friends at Dalton Brown Optometrist coming in at Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and Sky 99.5.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.